the way, you know, I'm not smart. I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Hello, greetings, friends. It's Thursday, March 2nd. It's Chapo coming at you. Me and Matt today, but joining us is a gentleman who I name-checked at the beginning of our last episode. So in lieu of citing his much better ideas than mine, I figured I will just have him on the show. So back again, it's our old friend, my lifestyle guru and influencer, the great Jacob Bacharach. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be able to take full credit for my own ideas.
Well, I said to you about our child pizza factories at the beginning of our interview with Will Sommer.
Yeah, the real Pizzagate. Yes. As always, the reality behind the curtain is both more horrible and even more ridiculous than the most wild fever dreams of the lumpen American population.
I mean, I don't know. We talked about it with Will Sommer, but I just wanted to ask your perspective. Like, how do you view like the QAnon like creating this like 21st century like sexual panic and like hysteria about kids and grooming and shit like that? Like, where is this all going, Jacob?
Yeah, I where it's going, I don't know, because it doesn't feel like it's quite. This is a horrible thing to say. It doesn't feel like it's actually quite reached the full peak of the fever pitch, after which it would recede a little bit. It still feels like it's on a bit of an upswing, searching for traction among the full broad population. But as I said in a couple of sort of offhanded tweets, it does feel to me like there's a sort of just a vague general apprehension of just the true grinding Stygian Lovecraftian horror underlying the entire sort of socioeconomic system in which we live, but people just aren't capable of envisioning a different socio-political order for, I think, a lot of reasons that you probably talk about frequently, you know, on this show. And so have sort of grasped towards this, speaking of movie mindset, this sort of heavily pop culture inflected sort of grab bag conspiratorial theory of sort of all of the moral panics of the last 50, 60 years, and sort of incorporated them into this one hellhound of a conspiracy theory that has the unique strength of being able to universally incorporate any new material into its structure. Like, there is nothing, it seems, at this point that can't just be pulled into that broader system of beliefs and incorporated. It's like pre-modern religion. It's like pre-Christian Near Eastern conquest, where you just take over the next village and incorporate their gods into your own.
Yeah, just add them to the pantheon of gods back in Rome. Yeah,
that's right.
Add it to the pantheon of children at Comic Ping Pong Pizza.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, meanwhile, just continuing to add children to the actual factory-based workforce of the United States.
Yeah. It's
wonderful.
Cleaning out slaughterhouses. Yeah.
We'll take their gods and their children and women.
I have a smaller specific idea for where I think this is going. And I'm expecting in the next year or so, certainly as we get into the presidential election at a state level, because we've already seen Tennessee has just banned drag just as a concept. Drag has just been banned, even though their governor apparently did a cute little photo shoot when he was in high school. But that's completely different because, you know, that was like a jocks and cheerleaders trade clothes and yuck it up, you know, but that's different than drag, or at least according to him. But I'm thinking, I'm expecting to see at the state levels to go further than a ban on drag. I think in the next year or so, we're going to see state level bans on dressing butch if you're a woman, or dressing a little bit, you know, fashionable if you're a fella, you know? So like if you're a guy wearing skinny jeans, you know, the morale, you're going to have to bag them up. You're going to have to get those JNCOs out of the closet because you got to dress like a man again, baby.
I can totally imagine just being like tackled black bag and renditioned by a bunch of former operators for accidentally walking too close to like the women's underwear on my way back to the kitchenware in a TJ Maxx. Like they see me brush too close to like to a set of enticing panties, even though I'm just there to get a no stick pan, just rendition me to Guantanamo for the rest of my life.
I'm thinking sort of like Marie Kondo style audits of your wardrobe, you know, just sort of like if you're a lady, you got does wearing pants inspire joy? No, take this gingham skirt.
That does feel that sort of combination of the sort of like Scientological psychic audit along with sort of lifestyle guru minimalization of home decor does seem like it's ultimately on a intersect. They're on two intersecting tracks that are going to cross at some point, like a terrible economist's diagram.
Moving on to something, to another conspiracy theory that is heavily pop culture infused. You remember the Boys to Men song, "It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday"? For the national security community, it will be so hard to say goodbye to Havana Syndrome. Now I'm a guy for the CIA. Havana Syndrome.
What?
Now,
wait a minute. What are you telling me? What about Havana Syndrome? It's gotten worse. That they've created a new, even more powerful laser. What's the news?
Yes, it is. It is now metastasized into Santiago Syndrome. I don't fucking know. But this is. Hey, look. Well, here's the deal. You know, we have to put on our like get the mind beams correctly attuned here, because this is. I will say, Havana Syndrome is fake, according to the CIA. So it seems like we're having sort of a inter-deep state sort of a civil war here between the State Department and Tony Blinken, who's saying, I will not discount the lived experiences of State Department employees, and the CIA, who's saying that, like, yeah, it's not real. There are no energy directives.
That's because they want these fucking gold brickers to go back to work already.
Yes.
That's right. They are undercutting the commercial real estate market in Arlington, Alexandria, and Prince George's County, and they must go back to the office. I have a theory, because so the intelligence community is now coming out and saying that Havana Syndrome is fake, but that lab leak theory is real. So I have a horrifying premonition at some point that the people who were previously suffering from Havana Syndrome are going to claim to have suffered from early exposure to a Chinese bioweapon. and that's the way the circle is going to get squared.
Just reading from the Washington Post briefly, it says, their reporting says, the mysterious ailment known as Havana Syndrome did not result from the actions of a foreign adversary, according to an intelligence report that shatters a long disputed theory that hundreds of U.S. personnel were targeted and sickened by a clandestine enemy wielding energy waves as weapons. The new intelligence assessment caps a years long
effort.
Well,
when you say it like that, it sounds silly.
Can you cut in a clip of Jose Chung saying words, mere words?
You were not experiencing Havana Syndrome. You merely saw Neptune in retrograde.
Swamp gas.
Swamp gas, exactly. Says the new intelligence assessment caps a years-long effort by the CIA and several other U.S. intelligence agencies to explain why career diplomats, intelligence officers, and others serving in the U.S. missions around the world experience what they described as strange and painful acoustic sensations. The effects of this mysterious trauma shorten careers.
Yeah, Justin Bieber.
Rihanna's Super Bowl performance.
I gotta say, it was a little low energy. I know people got mad when you say that, but
yeah. Well, they needed some of those beams, the energy beams, to
they needed to put some freaking energy in there.
Put some energy in it.
It says here, several intelligence agencies participated in the review of approximately 1,000 cases of anomalous health incidents, the term the government uses to describe a constellation of physical symptoms, including ringing in the ears, followed by pressure in the head and nausea, headaches, and acute discomfort. One always wants to be humble, one official said, and we looked at what additional information we would need to change the conclusions. The official added that some work on finding a source for the health conditions continues, notably at the Defense Department, and that intelligence agencies were prepared to lend their support to that effort. In a statement, CIA Director William J. Burns said analysts had conducted one of the largest and most intensive investigations in the agency's history. I and my leadership team stand firmly behind the work of the conducted and the findings. I want to be absolutely clear, these findings do not call into question the experiences and real health issues that the U.S. government personnel and their family members, including CIA's own officers, have reported while serving our country, Burns said. We will continue to remain alert to any risks to the health and well-being of agency officers to ensure access to care and to provide officers the compassion and respect they deserve. I love that the CIA, even the CIA uses the phrase access to health care, because it's funny because, like, they're the only people under 65 in this country who don't need access to healthcare, because all these Havana Syndrome gold brickers fucking got a special bill passed by Congress. It took them 5 minutes to write and pass that law, which gave all of these fucking charlatans free healthcare for life.
It's amazing. It did fly through Congress with bipartisan support. And if you go back and look at the, like, contemporaneous reporting, like, I don't know, when was the height of Havana Syndrome? The 2017-18, when the most sort of occurrences were happening? I feel like it was reported on incredibly credulously by the mainstream press.
Oh, my God,
with none of the skepticism they retain for, I don't know, pink-haired college kids and trans children. Like, none of that, the scaremongering, you know, like, what would you do if your child was suffering from Havana Syndrome?
Jacob.
It was all like...
Jacob, you have to understand, all we have are anecdotes about Havana Syndrome because the data just isn't there yet. So I would withhold any conclusions until we have a longitudinal study of Havana Syndrome sufferers and if any of them maybe experience regret for working for the CIA.
I will appropriately modify my Bayesian priors on the basis of that important corrective.
I don't know. I mean, like, the national security communities, they're going to have to take this one on the chin. But I think we said it before, Matt, I think you have it exactly right. What is really going on here? It's like basically a passive sort of form of striking by people who work in the national security community.
Yeah. Quiet quitting.
They're quiet quitting because they've experienced so much acoustic damage to their brains by energy directed weapons.
I had a boss at an old job, and he was actually a pretty nice guy, so I won't blow him up by name or company or anything. But anytime I would see him out at the bar one night, I knew that the next day he would call me and tell me that he had a migraine and wasn't coming into the office. I mean, if there's one thing we know about America's intelligence communities, even in this day and age, it's that they don't mind tying one on. So this all seems to me to be a combination of being the worst people in the world and having some sort of vestigial conscience, drinking too heavily, and also having most of your jobs be on, like, U.S. military bases that are full of, like, depleted uranium munitions and God only knows what other poisons and toxins just leaching into the soil that you're on every day.
Speaking of media credulity, someone pointed this out to me the other day. There was a recent episode of Law and Order about Havana Syndrome, and there was this, like, tearful moment on the stand, like, the final break before it ended, like, the final segment where they're, like, in the trial, and this woman's on the stand, and she's like, I thought he had turned violent, and, like, I reported him to the police, and I didn't know it was Havana Syndrome. I wish I could take it back. He's not guilty.
In the American system of justice, there are two syndromes. I don't know how to finish that one.
Well, yeah, the people's brains are cooked by two separate but equally important high frequency energy beams.
But I think this is actually we might be onto something here, because if you guys are Law and Order universe fans, if there's one thing we know from Law and Order, it's that neither the first most obvious suspect nor the Correct. Second suspect is ever guilty. So neither the original acoustic weapon nor the subsequent radiological directed energy weapon is the guilty party in Havana Syndrome. So clearly there is a third person on the edge of the guest cast who's got to be responsible. Fauci, maybe.
It's always Fauci.
It's or Von D. Curtis Hall. It's usually him. He's usually guilty if he's on Law and Order. But I just want to say, like, just wrapping up the Havana Syndrome thing, no matter what it was or like who, like why these people started like experiencing this mass hysteria, it worked because they all have healthcare now for the rest of their lives for their, you know, hangovers. So good on them. Like I said, they're the only people under 65 who can say that. So I don't know. I'm thinking of developing some sympathetic ailments related to my work as well. But my I don't know. It'd have to be work for the, I don't know, the FBI that I do.
Or from the CIA, because couldn't CIA, you have, yeah. You could have inherited it in some sort of Lamarckian version of
epigenetic trauma.
That's right.
Anyway, we touched on it briefly, but moving from you know, one press driven hysteria to another, can we talk a little bit about what's going on these days at the failing New York Times? Because
the failing New York Times.
Failing New York Times continues to fail. I mean, they're dealing with a sort of newsroom uprising. I mean, I want to get into that in a second. But Jacob, like just today, there was reporting out of St. Louis about the so-called Reed affidavit, which has been used so heavily in the Times, like sort of, I don't know. How would you describe like the Times coverage of trans people and trans issues and how the Reed affidavit and how like it plays into their kind of, you know, a flashlight under the chin, campfire story, like horror stories for like, you know, the moms and dads of America.
Yeah. I mean, the Times is a, I'll give my opinion about their coverage. The Times is a sophisticated enough news organization still, you know, as are places like, you know, the Post and even the major cable news carriers to avoid the Reed affidavit like the plague and have not incorporated it into their own reporting. That sort of sensationalistic nonsense had to get laundered out into the mainstream through America's favorite Pittsburgh carpet fortune heir, Barry Weiss's fun time newsletter, Scholastic, anti-trans Scholastic highlights rag. But you know, it seeped out, you know, through there and then through the right wing press and then through the sort of, you know, Substack adjacent media into public consciousness, sort of as the Times in particular was sort of reaching the apotheosis of its own, as you said, sort of flashlight under the chin, scaremongering coverage of so-called youth trans issues. You know, with the Times doing a very, you know, very sober minded chin stroking, you know, what happens if a parent finds out that little Susie has decided that she wants to be called little Johnny in school and school hasn't told her, hasn't told mommy. And you're sort of like typical kind of upper middle class fear inducing crusade journalism on the part of the Times. And those things then, you know, all just sort of like seep out into the popular culture and get mixed up in the minds of people who aren't necessarily, you know, following it particularly closely, so that all of a sudden it feels like this is just a thing that it has to be talked about. And that has become a touchstone of political debate in America, even though it is ultimately, and I say this as a person who's like, you know, deeply invested in supporting, you know, trans rights and gender affirming care for youth. But, you know, it feels like this monumental issue, which when in reality affects a tiny portion of society. But the Times has been, I think, particularly harmful in sort of laundering that, you know, very obvious, hysterical, over the top scaremongering from places like Barry Weiss and Jesse Single and other commentators of that ilk. Through this kind of lens of sober reportage, which I think has done a great disservice. I mean, as we've seen in all of these crazy anti-trans care bills that have been introduced all around the country, the New York Times is being cited by the conservatives who are introducing these bills in state legislatures as basically proving that this is a deeply unsettled form of medical treatment. There are all sorts of terrible unknowns about it. It's deeply traumatic. It's being pushed on youth too quickly, and therefore something has to be done legislatively. Even though, in reality, it's a difficult to access form of care for a very small and very put upon minority in this country.
I mean, to my great shame, I unfortunately got into it with Jesse Signal over this issue. And I mean, like the point that he got mad at me because I asked him, like, in his opinion, how many what's the correct number of trans people? Because, like, I think like the overwhelming, like, uh, like the the sort of like the point of their report of his reporting on this, or like are people of his ilk, is like, oh, obviously, like, you know, trans people deserve our support and they deserve full and equal rights under the laws. But there's a certain percentage of them that's sort of like they're capping, or they've been pressured into it in some way, or that we need to like slow down or pump the brakes on it, or just maybe like, you know, I don't know, like slow things down until we can figure out what's going on here. But like, I guess just more broader, like, why do you think that like this issue has found like so many otherwise liberal people getting into bed with like the libs of TikTok crowd?
Well, one, I think it's because hail Dr. Freud or whatever, but I think a lot of these individuals, by the looks of them, are, let's just say, perhaps less confident and comfortable in their own presentation of masculinity within an America that's become increasingly weird about masculinity than they otherwise ought to be. Like, there is a weird element of projection for the Jesse Singles and Matt Iglesiases and John Chaits of the world in their sort of obsession with the notion of either of the masculinization of women as they see it, or the demasculinization or emasculinization of men. I really do think that there's a weird underlying psychology to the sort of particular type of centrist who is drawn to that type of argumentation. But I think then more broadly, you know, again, you look at like the Times coverage and the way that it so often centers, basically operates from the point of view of a sort of like a notional parent of a middle schooler in a household with a $400,000 a year income, right? Probably somewhere in the Northeast. And the way that it operationalizes these sorts of fears about control of children and access to culture, and particularly in an age when so much of, it seems like, youth culture is mediated through weird online fora that like parents don't have access to. So in a way, I think that it's almost some of the same like underlying psychology that you get in something like QAnon or Pizzagate, where it's like, it just, it feels like there's something happening at the edge of their apprehension. But rather than like try to think about it, you know, just like, you know, structurally or sociologically, psychologically, and try to incorporate it into like an actual sort of holistic view of like what our society looks like now, I think it becomes this like this gnawing, this deep gnawing fear, like something is happening to my child, and it's become medicalized, and it's happening outside of my field of vision because it's the teachers and it's the social workers and it's the medical establishment and it's the elite universities. By the way, the elite universities that I'm desperate to get my kid into in 10 years, but that I also distrust. And so I think it becomes this weird miasma that then can only ever become more hysterical, because like, well, it's hard to back away from, as we saw with our buddy John Chait, who like very credulously in New York Magazine, like repeated all of the hilariously, incredibly obviously wrong assertions of that Reid affidavit, you know, children are going into
like lurid tales of kids coming in and being like, I identify as a rock. And then they're like, oh, please have these powerful drugs. Like,
have these powerful drugs, which, as somebody pointed out in Twitter, if somebody came in and said, I want to be an attack helicopter, why would you prescribe estrogen?
to prescribe some
like motor oil,
belt-fed 50 caliber ammunition, buddy.
Yeah, right, exactly. A slap a Wagner tape in there and take her for a spin. So, you know, credulously reproduces these obviously false accusations, is then confronted on it with people saying, can you really possibly believe that children are coming in and saying, I'm a rock, I'm a helicopter, and, you know, being prescribed drugs and being given actual phalloplasties and mastectomies, like within a matter of weeks or months? And he says, and so his first step to back off from that is to say, well, listen, I'm not saying it is or is not true, but I'm saying, if it were, would that not be bad? And if you concede that it would be bad, then don't you buy, therefore, further concede that trans healthcare is happening too fast for children? An incredibly bizarre argument. And then when it was further shown that, yes, in fact, these things are demonstrably false, there's not even an if. It's like there is clear evidence that this is a confabulation at best, a completely made up, deliberately made up fiction at worst. He said, oh, well, as we were joking about before, I guess I'm going to have to reevaluate my priors, but I still think I still think that the precautionary principle of some kind dictates that we basically believe the worst things we hear.
It's the classic thing. It's the classic thing of being a little too having a little too itchy of a trigger finger when you see something come across your timeline. You're like, oh, I can't believe this. And you quote retweet it. And then you're like, everyone's just like, that was a joke. Like, that this is obviously a satire or a fake post or whatever. And then, like, instead of just like taking that on the chin, you have to go, aha. But the fact that I believed it was real says something important about our society.
Yeah.
And it seems like whether it's Signal or Chait or even the New York Times, I think there's like a weird thing going on here where like in their coverage of it, they conflate and flatten a lot of things. Like they will often be talking about people who are not minors, but like the people who are 18, 19, 20 years old when they transition, and then like referring to them as if they are still like, you know, 15, 16, 17. And also like I think a purposeful flattening of social and medical transitioning, where it's just like they're erasing all distinction between those things and often passing off people who are adults and transitioned as adults as like sort of duped children who were like forced into something they weren't ready for.
Yeah. I mean, you see that frequently, like, it's like as you're reading and you realize, so this person they're talking about is like 25 years old. And but even with youth, it happens. So one of the things I think that you find in the coverage is you have to read really closely to get the timelines. So even when they are talking about like perhaps a child, like an actual minor who maybe socially transitioned and then after that maybe went on to puberty blockers, let's say, for example, the narratives compress that. And they make it seem like it's like all of a piece, like a person walks in the door one day and then they have one follow-up appointment and all of a sudden all of these things have happened. But if you actually like dig down into the coverage, again, at least if you're sticking to the, you know, legacy news media like the Times, you'll often find that these things are occurring over periods of years. So you might have, you know, a child who changes their name and begins socially transitioning, you know, at 10, and then they go on puberty blockers at 12. That's a 2-year period during which that person would be undergoing ongoing, regular, repeated psychological analysis, medical visits, social monitoring, et cetera. And so, you know, even in those cases, it's often made to seem as if there's like no gatekeeping here, which I think is one of the things that the Iglesiases and the Chaits and all those bozos are constantly kind of harping on, like, oh, the problem is that there's insufficient gatekeeping. There aren't enough obstacles so that, you know, any kid who goes on Tumblr one time can become an attack helicopter tomorrow. But, you know, in reality, actually, the problem is the opposite. I mean, speaking of no one under 65 having any fucking healthcare in this country, it's incredibly difficult to access this care. You've got to live close enough to a clinic that even provides the care. The waiting lists are months long. There are all sorts of barriers to access. You got to have supportive parents who are able to pay the co-pays, even if it is covered by insurance, or raise the money or borrow the money if it's not covered by their insurance. So the idea that there's like this, you can walk right in and access this care, especially as a minor, is completely false. But the opposite is how it's presented. And that, I think, adds to this kind of scaremongering where, again, people think, oh, my God, they're doing this irreparable thing and it's happening in a matter of hours.
Chris, did you is it an audio issue?
No, I just wanted to add to that throughout all of this, and Jacob basically just said the same thing, that the biggest tell for a lot of this hysteria to me has always been that it has been centered around, in America, the idea that there is too much access to too easy of healthcare, which has always seemed like the preposterous underpinning of this whole hysteria. But Jacob was just basically saying that, you know?
I was talking to a friend the other day. I can't go into my dermatologist's office and get a new fucking skin cream for the dry patch on my arm without getting blood work and prior approval from my very good insurance. So the idea that like that a much more invasive, hard to access and rare medical care is just like
that they're just giving it away.
They're just giving it away.
Well, I mean, like, yeah, but they're just giving it away. And like a lot of people who are otherwise liberal in every fucking regard are like, you know, they're falling hook, line and sinker for like the school litter box fucking line. And I don't know, like outside the anxious masculinity of the bozo class, I think there's kind of like a generational antagonism going on here. Cause like, particularly among women in like who cover this issue, because like I think the question for them is not so much are trans women women, it's are young women women. And I think there's like there's a real dividing line there, and I think that's what's like, at least by my lights, accounting for a lot of this like anger and sort of feelings of betrayal that you read into this. But Jacob, I wanted to ask you too, like this has become sort of like leaving the issues of like the human rights of trans people aside, this has become a story about the media. And I wanted your take because, you know, like I've been following you for a long time back in the good old days, you know, we're all old heads here. But like, is it funny in a little way that like this is all centering around like how can the New York Times be a better newspaper? Because it's just like, haven't people given up the ghost on that already?
No, they haven't. I mean, because what the fuck else is there? Because there are, so even yeah. these people that were, even the people that we're talking about, right? You know, even that, like for the anxious suburbanite, but the anxious suburbanite in, you know, Connecticut, making several hundred thousand dollars a year, the New York Times core constituency, there is an incredible, I think, anxiety because they, like everybody else, are awash in this like ocean of information, misinformation and disinformation and whatever the fuck other neologism we want to apply to it, and are still like grasping for a source that isn't screaming weirdos on CNN or inaccessible niche online media platforms or soporific NPR, which increasingly seems to have like just completely lost its way and its hold, perhaps just owing to the fact that no one listens to the radio anymore, at least unless they're listening to conservative talk radio or drive time sports. And so
whenever I accidentally come across NPR, I feel like I'm Edward G. Robinson at the end of Soylent Green. It's just sort of like, talking about soporific, it's just lulling me into like oblivion.
It makes me feel like Data when he realizes he's in the San Francisco of the 19th century. Like, why is Guinan wearing that frock coat? What's going on?
London is my bellhop?
Why is Jack London my bellhop? I think that both, so, you know, among news consumers, I think there is still, obviously, the New York Times subscription numbers keep going up. For all people on Twitter talk about cancel your subscription, the New York Times keeps reporting better and better subscription numbers. So more and more people are grasping for something that seems like it's not totally crazy, like that a place where they can get information. And likewise for writers, group of contributors to the New York Times wrote a letter to them, basically to their standards editor, complaining about the way that trans issues have been framed in the paper. I have contributed to the New York Times before I signed on to the letter, but look, there aren't that many places that pay contributors well anymore. The New York Times doesn't pay them well, but it pays them at least better than a lot of other places. So whether you're a producer of written media and journalism or a consumer of it, I think that there's just a lot of people who have a deep investment in having a place, whether it's the Post or the Times, maybe the LA Times, there's like a handful of them left, that's still like a newspaper in the sense that we all used to like think that we had a shared reality of a newspaper. As for me, I want to support my fellow writers and contributors and freelancers to the extent possible. So I'll sign on with them. But the idea that the Times is going to become a better outfit around these issues, I think I don't think it's going to happen. In fact, we saw some really horrible responses from their management to this letter internally. So I think the likelihood of having positive change at that paper is not particularly high at the moment.
Yeah. And like, I've made fun of it for the last week or two on the show, but like this spurious distinction that they keep trying to draw between objective and activist journalism, I think is really telling because, you know, Vanity Fair covered it. And like, I forget who was quoted in it, but it was a Times staffer, I think, made a good point, which is the idea that like, if you are in a newspaper or even the newspaper of record, It is your job to determine what is in the public interest, and that is always going to involve value judgments and like and is necessarily political. So like this idea that there's this like objective standard where like, you know, on the one side there are people who embrace trans people and their right to exist, and on the other side there are people who would like you know, like nothing better than to, let's just say, have them go away. And, you know, like, so the question is like, what's in the public interest? And like, there's no objective way that you can make that determination.
Well, I agree, but and even more to the case, the not only is it a spurious distinction that they're making, it's also it flies in the face of the actual both editorial and managerial practices of the newspaper. In fact, like what we were joking about right at the top about you know, children working in slaughterhouses and food factories and Ben and Jerry's production facilities all around the country. Like, how do we know about that? Well, actually, because the New York Times is doing some excellent crusading activist reporting around precisely that point. And the New York Times, the way it's covering that particular issue is not a view from nowhere. Like, there are some corporations in America that want to employ children and others that think
there are some children that
idea.
Like working in slaughterhouses.
There's still some children like working in Bovine Academy, you know, speaking of higher education in this country, you know, so they are like that. That is crusading activist journalism. I think it's commendable journalism in this particular case around this particular subject, obviously with two outcomes and impacts in mind. One is like social impact, like hopefully there's going to be some sort of action on the executive level or some sort of legislation to address child labor in this country and migrant child labor. At least that's, you can tell that's the hope, you know, a sort of hope for outcome. And secondarily, to, you know, win journalism prizes, which also generally go to crusading activist journalism, not to sort of dull recitations of the latest debate about a particular form of medical care. So in addition to it just being a spurious distinction to begin with, because ideology and politics are just baked into coverage to begin with, it's also just false that the paper doesn't do activist journalism. It's just completely false.
Well, moving on to the reading series for today, I chose a selection from the failing New York Times, or actually, as according to you, Jacob, the not so failing New York Times, because those numbers are going up, up, up. But to me, they will always be the failing New York Times. This is the guest essay from this week in the opinion section. My liberal campus is pushing free thinkers to the right. This is by Adam S. Hoffman, a senior at Princeton. You think Matt Karp has been doing the Ludvico treatment to this guy to stop his free thinking.
I hate it when it's not so bad when I'm pushed to the right. It's when my free thinking colleagues and co-students are pushed to the right by censorious liberalism that I really begin to get concerned. I want their thinking to remain free and not to be enclosed by conservative or liberal orthodoxies.
How many of these articles have been written at this point?
Are we sure that this is not
just one of the old ones and they just changed the name?
Number the stars in the sky and the blades of grass on the lawn.
This is from March 1st, 2023. So this is a real evergreen topic. So Adam Hoffman, senior at Princeton, writes, in the not-so-distant past, the typical college Republican idolized Ronald Reagan, fretted about the national debt, and read Edmund Burke. Political sophistication to that person implied belief in the status quo. For that bygone breed, an education at an elite institution was a moderating finishing school. Even then, American universities skewed liberal, but the conservatives of old had real opportunities to make their case and have their ideas respectfully challenged in the public square. At my own school, Princeton, I've been told politics are mostly separable from personal relationships. How things have changed. Today's campus conservatives embrace a less moderate, complacent, and institutional approach to politics. Instead of belief in the status quo, many tend towards scorched earth politics, but these changes aren't solely the consequence of a fractured national politics. They're also the results of puritanically progressive campuses that alienate conservative students from their liberal peers and college as a whole. The distrust of authority, the protest and disobedience that have characterized the left's activism over the past half century or so, have arrived on the right. The American universities that once served as moderating finishing schools have become breeding grounds for conservative firebrands. Now, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, this is an old head episode of the show. This is and like perhaps when I went to college, I don't think that the campus policing and anti-policing or just like the woke mind virus had not spread as far as it is today. But like,
excuse me, tell that to Jeremy Piven and the rest of those merry pranksters in the film PCU, which came out in like 1992.
PC? Politically correct. And it's not just politics, it's everything. It's what you eat, it's what you wear, and it's what you say. And if you don't watch yourself, you can get in a buttload of trouble.
It's never changed. Nothing has changed. It's all the same. The difference is that the institutions of higher learning in this country are being disassembled, are being taken into pieces. Like every fucking article about what's going on in the college campuses and all the crazy woke mobs or whatever the fuck, none of them point to the fact that the buildings are being stripped for fucking parts and they're taking out the copper wiring. It's a sinking ship. Like higher education as such is being dismantled, and you can't make sense of any of the affects of students or teachers in higher education without understanding that everybody in this is slowly coming to the realization that they're in a burning building. Like, I think about how there's a lot of anthropological research that was done about Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest and like potlatch societies. And that became very influential in American anthropology. And people kind of took it for granted. Like, this is how potlatch societies and tribal kinship networks worked in Pacific Northwest. And then generations pass and people start pointing out, well, all this research comes from European anthropologists showing up to observe these societies as they were dying at the moment that settled American society was choking them into oblivion. And so you can't really take the way that the societies functioned at that point and generalize it to the history of that society. And I think I always think the same thing looking at any of these articles about colleges now. None of them take into account that the fucking higher education is being destroyed, not just being dismantled from within, not just as a occupation, as a profession being annihilated, but also the promise that going to college will get you anything is being obliterated. Well, it's getting more and more expensive to go. And that means everybody in college, student and faculty, has in a fucking lifeboat morality where they are turned into these little Hobbesian demons tearing at each other because the fucking thing is going down.
Back to your invocation of PCU, though, the point I was going to make, where you said, like, you know, what does he say here? Like, it used to be that college, like campus conservatives weren't alienated from the student body and college as a whole. David Spade and his fellow Edmund Burke readers in PCU were very alienated from the campus scene. And like, if you are a campus conservative at any point in American history, the chances are you were alienated from your peer groups and the university at large. It is a freakish thing to be. Like, at no point were they ever embraced or, like, considered anything other than contemptible in American college culture. I don't know. Maybe post-60s or whatever. But, like, I remember, like, campus conservative was always a joke.
I mean, campus Democrats are nerds, too. Caring about politics when you are in college is dork shit one way or the other. But it takes a special breed of social malcontent to be like, I'm going to care about being a conservative while I'm in college.
Well, I also think that it's funny that it's like there's sort of like references to like, the conservatives of yore, ye old conservative shoppy, you used to envy Ronald Reagan. And like, this is like such a habit of conservative writing, too, which is this like atemporal, anachronistic, like invocation of an incredibly distant past, except the incredibly distant past is like what, like 18 years ago or something. Like they're not talking about, like, you know, about the boys at Harvard doing Edwardian cosplay and sucking each other off in bride's head rituals in the 19th century. Like, they're talking about, like, kids who went to Penn State in 2005. Like, it's just such a foreshortening of the historical imagination to make this point about this like sea change that hasn't really happened. But yeah, as you said, like, at least since the Vietnam War. Right. At least since the beginning of the student movement in the 60s and the Vietnam War, campus conservatism has been an outlier. And campus conservatives have responded to sort of like a degree of performative standoffishness and firebrand rhetoric to the puritanical excesses of the fucking hippies on the left. But that's been the true for the last half century.
Yeah, Jacob, it's like those accounts that are like Western civilization and, you know, traditional architecture that are like doing posts now that are like, this is what they've taken from us. And the thing that they've taken from us is not like the Parthenon. It's like Nintendo 64, which came out in 1996.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. It's as if, like, you know, the fragmentary remnants of Democritus and fucking Mike Tyson knockout occurred at exactly the same time.
Going back to Hoffman here, he says, the story of this transformation, according to the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, ding, 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 ding. If your op-ed piece endorses the work of absolute con man Jonathan Haidt, America's favorite social scientist, then I think you can know where this is going. But starts around 2014, so okay, I had graduated, when Gen Z arrived on campus. The new progressive students were less tolerant of heterodox ideas and individuals. Demands to rescind invitations to speakers seemed to spike. The terms microaggression and trigger warning made it into everyday campus parlance. At Yale, for instance, a lecturer's suggestion that students should determine which Halloween costumes are acceptable for themselves ignited a firestorm. These changes were felt on my campus, too. Princeton has become much more politicized over the last 10 years, said Thomas Kelly, a philosophy professor. It also became more progressive. Diversity training sessions blatantly endorse progressive ideas. Espousing a colorblind ideal, for example, is deemed a micro-invalidation. Bureaucrats police conduct and speech. Many programs cater to left-wing causes. For those on the right, the experience is alienating. The typical American's views on gender ideology or American history are often irrelevant to his or her day-to-day life. But for the conservative college student, life is punctuated by political checkpoints. Classes may begin with requests for preferred pronouns or land acknowledgments. A student who jokes about the wrong subject may face social punishment. All students should welcome challenges to their most cherished beliefs, but from what I've seen on campus, students are not invited to debate. They're expected to conform.
Not invited to debate. Oh my, my God.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. It sounds awful. It does sound awful to go to college now. It does sound like it would be a huge pain in the ass. And everybody seems like they're fucking miserable. And really, it seems like the real problem is that this is one of the few places where you have to be around a lot of other people in a social situation. And at this point in American history, being around a lot of other people in a social situation is basically torture. Because everybody is an insane narcissist.
Well, I think that point is really well taken. And interestingly, and I have to give credit to my my beloved husband, actually, for pointing this out to some friends of ours the other night. You know, one of the interesting things about the American college campus, and even more so at an elite college campus, you know, at the Princetons and Harvards of the world, is that they're basically the last place, speaking of saving the cultural tradition of the West, they're basically the last place in America that basically an urban walkable village, right? That is the experience. That is the experience.
It's a 15-minute city. Princeton is a 15-minute city.
Princeton is a 15-minute city. But so you have all of these people whose brains have been fried from the constant stream of information through a thousand new media sources, all then being forced basically into a medieval village and forced to interact with each other and share and reinforce the most insane witchcrafty beliefs. And so it's sort of, it's inevitable that you're going to have social conflict and that, you know, a few people are going to get burned at the metaphorical stake. That's just the nature of village life. They should get out into the fields more.
And where everybody, and a place where everybody has been conditioned their entire life to think of themselves as consumers, where they are spending a ton of money, borrowing a ton of money to have this experience. They want it to be like they want it to be. Like, there's no way, given the conditions we find ourselves in at this point, to make the college experience some sort of lapidary Athenian idol, because no one lives in that fucking country. And you can't turn it into you can't turn college into some sort of pocket away from that unless you were to, for one thing, make it way, way, way less expensive to have to go to fucking college, for one thing.
Well,
to reduce the insane stakes at play here of the amount of money people are having to borrow to do it.
Yeah, I do think, though, that does point to, and this is speaking of the New York Times, only, you know, loving to cover like the smallest possible sliver of the population. I think that, and plenty of people have made this observation before, all of these trends and experiences tend to attenuate the further away you get from elite institutions. You know, like, I think that probably the experience of going to, like, you know, ASU or Alabama actually probably is less different in any case, less politically fraught than certainly going to Harvard, and probably not much more politically fraught than it was to go there in, you know, 1985, in part because, as you alluded to, Matt, I think, you know, most of those places have basically just been converted into technical colleges. I mean, we don't call them such, but they're it's all vocational training. So, I think it's the attempt to sort of graft that Athenian idol onto the modern hedge fund with a college attached that constitutes Princeton or Harvard or Yale that like produces the most maximal version of that kind of derangement.
How about we abolish the Ivy League? What if we just get rid of these stupid schools?
Yeah, none of their teams are good anyway.
Is that a possibility? Would that not be a bipartisan solution, and it would make us stop having to read these goddamn articles?
Well, they could,
I think, like, this is the answer to the question. Not like turn them public or any of that bullshit. Raise them to the ground. Salt the earth and just get rid of them. We do not need them. They're only annoying. They only exist to produce annoying people and to produce annoying discourse.
I can't help but think that if we got the troops together, we could come up with a with a plant-based league of educational institutions that would beat the pants off of the Ivy League.
Yeah. Kudzu League. How about that?
Yeah. The Monstera League.
No, like the top 20, 30 universities get just, they're done. They're gone. Nobody gets to go to them. We couldn't handle it. Okay, you happy? Now nobody gets to go to these. I think this is an actual solution. And until I hear somebody actually propose this, I don't want to hear them bitching about it. Because what is the solution to this? Does this asshole have an answer to this question other than complaining about it? No, none of them do. It is to fill space and time and to curate your victimhood complex.
Well, Matt, I mean, like, your solution is, of course, a noble and just one. And you think it would be one, a sort of a populist battle cry that could rally both the right and left. But that's not going to work on the Mr. Hoffmans of the world, because they want to go to fucking Yale and Princeton.
Tough shit. You don't get to go.
Well, they still value, you know, they still value the social output and the social capital that a degree from one of these places confers. And that's how you know. I mean, that's really too how you know that this is all pantomime, right? Because if you were serious about this, there are plenty of colleges in the United States that are much more friendly to conservative ideas, both actual conservative colleges and or places like, you know, like Stanford, for example, or UChicago, that are much friendlier to conservative ideology, especially in certain disciplines. And those are good schools, too. But you elected to go to a very particular one. You clearly knew what you were getting into going in. And now, in fact, you're actually both trading on its reputation and using the cultural currency of trashing its reputation for clicks and likes to advance your own social and career capital in just the crassest way possible.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit because, you know, like there's not much to talk about here. But Hoffman says sometimes young conservative agitators are dismissed cynically as attention seekers or opportunists. But in my experience, the negative consequences of conservative activism on campus, both personal and professional, far outweigh any benefit that they might incur. And tellingly, most conservatives report censoring themselves during their college years. Some might think that this pervasive progressivism would encourage conservative students to change their views. But in fact, it has the opposite effect. Graduates of schools like Loyola, University of Chicago, George Washington University, and Mount Holyoke have described how the rampant leftism on their campuses pushed them to the right. A 2017 article in the Washington Examiner quotes a Furman University graduate saying that the aggressive leftist culture on campus made me a more radical conservative because I had only two options: abandon my beliefs and conform, or fight back. She chose to fight back.
How? I mean, at the end of the day, what are you doing? You're voting Republican harder? That's it. Like, you were voting Republican, and now you're just voting Republican, like, but more basedly?
Yeah, I know. I think that's it, because I think Mr. Hoffman here is like, In the university of yore, it incubated, like you said, a finishing school for people who'd go on to be conservatives who revered Ronald Reagan and the status quo. And what he's saying is because of the land acknowledgements and the pronouns, they're all becoming feral-based groypers, which, like, he doesn't really want to truck with. So he's saying that, like, oh, like, they're fucking up my, because, like, he's saying, like, probably the jobs that I want to get in Washington are going to the fucking, going to the based people. They're going to the people who've taken the red pill. And, you know, and it's because of the campus progressivism. I think that's what's going on in this piece. Skipping ahead to the end here, Mr. Trump and Ron DeSantis are different kinds of politicians from John McCain and Mitt Romney. To be sure, top universities have produced outspoken conservatives like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley. But now formative years at elite institutions that have gone woke are convincing right-leaning students and heterodox thinkers that society's most august institutions, from media outlets to universities, are fundamentally broken and need to be set on a different path. If colleges don't want to produce a new generation of conservative firebrands, they need to pump the brakes on campus progressivism. Campuses that are the more welcoming to conservatives are in the university's best own interests. So there we go. That's Reid Hoffman talking about his bold heterodox ideas.
What are... Nobody ever says what the heterodox ideas are.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are they? Because it seems to me that they basically consist of... that there are sort of like two semi-overlapping... circles in the diagram of what constitutes heterodox ideas. I mean, one of them is just saying the N word. That's on the one hand, and then all of the other ones are just fucking mid-century University of Chicago economic ideas that still basically predominate in the United States, or what, that like men are from Mars and women are from Venus. I mean, I suppose we could say that that idea has become like less orthodox in our society over the last 20 years, but it's still like effectively the received wisdom for the vast majority of people in this country in one way or another. So, you know, the idea that by embracing traditional gender roles and supply side economics, you are violating the orthodoxies of American society is absurd. I mean, it's completely crackpot. The people who have heterodox ideas are all those puritanical liberal weirdos who are yelling at you about land acknowledgements, at least within the context of our society writ large and not within the fucking micro celebrity realm of whatever social media platform you're on.
I mean, I think it's just similar to the way the word like woke has just become a catch-all for like, I mean, like, because it used to be like, I mean, was it Thomas Chatterbox Williams, Matt? Like, you noticed that he got into some hot water over the Scott Adams Dilbert thing, because he was saying like, well, yeah, he should have been canceled. He was saying shit that was racist 30 years ago. Not something like, he didn't trip over some social mora that was like invented a week ago by college students. He was just like, no, we need segregation now, segregation forever.
Well, yeah, Thomas, I mean, yeah, but that, you're right. That's. It is always a step too far is always just like a thing that seems novel to me. But even in that article, like earlier where he said, and having written for the New York Times, I could feel the heavy hand of an editor there. He said cancellations of events on campus seemed to spike. I absolutely guarantee that in the original draft of that op-ed, it said campus cancellations of conservative speakers spiked. And then the editor said, well, you're not actually one of our permanent columnists, so we do have to fact check you. So can you provide any, can you provide any reasonable doubt of that? Yeah. So we're, and then the answer is, oh no, it actually turns out that like speaker cancellations have basically remained flat. It's just that you've heard of a few more these days because your brain is constantly plugged into an outrage machine. And so they had to change the language to, it seemed to like everything here is it's all individualized perceptual stuff. It's not like we've done a longitudinal study of, you know, the number of land acknowledgements that have occurred in on the first day of classes in American universities over the last 25 years. It's just like it's just vibes that, oh yeah, I didn't remember seeing this happen in a movie I saw about college when I was a teenager.
Yeah, everybody is Julianne Moore from Safe. Like, that's it. That's the default mode of perception in America. You are projecting a paranoid fantasy around you, and you interact with the world through a digital matrix that feeds you something that you think of as the world, but you are actually selecting for the entire time subconsciously. And then you react to that. And that's true of the hysterical snowflakes on campus that this guy has to deal with. It's true of this guy. And it's not a thing that is in anyone's power to change. It is the reality that we find ourselves trapped within. And all that anyone can do is try to make a little bit of hay for themselves by pointing out something that one segment of this terminally paranoid group of people can respond to and go, yes, I've noticed that too. You're a hero. Here's money.
Well, I think we should leave it there for this week. But as long as we're trapped in this reality, I'm glad it can be with you, gentlemen. Jacob Bacharach, it is always a joy to talk to you. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, gang. Wrapping it up now. Until next time. Bye-bye.